Hi there. My name is David Leese, and I'm your proud host of Leaders on the Frontier. And we are celebrating today as we look at Canada, our beloved nation. And we want to welcome all of you to this live broadcast and discussion. We're talking about our country, Canada in 2024, a confident, resilient nation, or a fearful, fractured country? That's the question. And with me here today to talk about this is Lieutenant Colonel David Redmond. So welcome, David.
Hi, David. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on again, my friend. We've had a lot of tremendous discussions over the years, and we're glad that you could join us, given your stellar 27 years in the Canadian Armed Forces. You've served in many nations around the world. And you've also served with as a senior fellow with the Frontier Center. And today we just released a, I think, a landmark paper, really, about Canada in 2024. And that paper talks a lot about many different issues that I think are really foundational for us as a nation. And I'm so glad that you could take the lead on preparing that report, and you can find it on the Frontier Center website, so be sure to look at that. So today, we are also grateful that you as an audience, both on X and YouTube, could join us. We're grateful. We have we're just so delighted by the response, with several thousand people joining in on this discussion, as well as the recording. So we welcome your questions on this very important, heartfelt topic. And I think you're going to find it fascinating as we really talk about the foundational understandings of our country. It's often been said in the good book that a house divided cannot stand. And I think that goes for any nation. And I think that your paper, David, really, I think, represents a wake-up call for many as we think about our nation. And I do want to read a brief section about it, because I think it's a fascinating example. And you reflect as a young man in 1967 to our proud country when we celebrated our centennial, and there was all kinds of events across the country, coast to coast, that celebrated our centennial in 1967. And you said, Canadian teenagers are told not to be proud of their country, which seems strange, as many people of the world still want desperately to become Canadian. The current government relishes apologizing for actions from long ago by people in completely different circumstances in a much different international context. Universities seem entranced by an agenda that destroys democratic values, rights, and freedoms. Diaspora march routinely in the streets of our cities, supporting illegal terrorist organizations, demanding the death of both citizens here and abroad. Our police and courts take no action, or in fact support these illegal acts. Teenagers rightly question who will be next to be called out, shamed, or attacked. Our current federal government, many of our provincial territorial governments, and our municipal government stand silently by, or in some cases support, the destruction of our values, laws, and national interests. Confidence has been turned into fear and shame. Canada has become irrelevant on the world stage. The ultimate question is, what do Canadians want Canada to be? Why is that the question today, David?
I want to go back to 1967 and the world that I grew up in. I was born in 1954, so when Canada's centenary happened, I was a brand new teenager. And I remember the mood in Canada was one of a strong, unified country. We had a real pride in our past, and we deserved to have it. We had stood well above other nations of our size during World War I, World War II, and Korea. In fact, in Korea, we were the third largest contingent trying to stand for democracy. We had a vibrant democracy, and it was very participative. People from all stripes and all backgrounds, left, right, center, everyone held honest, open discussions that were respectful. We had the whole world watched Canada. We were internationally recognized, and people turned to us for advice and solutions when difficult things happened in the world, and we had a truly vibrant, strong economy. And so, in fact, the world looked at us back then, and most people, international authors said, the next 100 years belongs to Canada. Well, it's 50 years later, and we've stopped thinking with a vision for our country. We've stopped trying to define what Canada will look like in 20 years, and we've now focused down on daily, weekly, or monthly issues where you never know what's going to be thrown up in the air next to try and destroy internally. And now we're a fractured country. We've been taught to be ashamed of our history instead of proud of it or even to learn from it. We have completely shattered democratic institutions. Our election system is in question. Our legislatures are in turmoil. Our courts, our schools, our medical system. The media is completely, the mainstream media is completely partisan. Our cost of living, our economy is broken. People can't make the bills at the end of the month, and we're ignored and shunned by our allies. So in the 50 short years from that wonderful feeling of our centenary until now, we've stopped thinking big. We've stopped trying to define our national interests. What are the true strategic interests of our country, which would then serve as a backstop to make sure that the decisions we make on a daily basis are for the long term, not for short-term political gains.
Wow. So you've just summarized quite almost a point of reality therapy here around your take on the state of our country, and that we have really kind of a fundamental problem. It's almost like we don't have a sense of vision and clear purpose and unity as a team. Is that kind of the bottom line of what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that we've got to the point where political leaders are more interested in creating division and fear than they are in having a vision of what Canada would look like 20 to 25 years from now, and making decisions that then are coherent to take us to that vision of 20 years, when it appears their only interest right now is to win more seats in the next election in a year and a half.
Wow. Well, that's a very powerful summation, Lieutenant Colonel David Redmond. So I'm looking to the audience. What do you think? We're going to make our way through some of the highlights of this paper that was just released early this morning from Frontier. And again, we encourage you to look at it on our website at the Frontier Center for Public Policy. And we welcome your feedback. This is a foundational issue. So speaking of foundations, why is this question, when everything is said and done, so important, so foundational for the building of a country, David?
A nation, in my definition, it really hinges on two core principles. Number one, on a group of people, of humans, who band together, who share common ethics and values. And then they live in an area that has defined borders. So when you talk about a nation, we're going to talk about all six national interests, but the first two are paramount. You have to have a unity of culture within a defined region which is defended and capable of being defended. And so if you define a nation that way, you'll see that what's been happening in the last 8 years has been to try and break up our common culture. In fact, we have a prime minister who said, there is no defining culture for Canada. Well, I personally strongly and vehemently disagree. I know from my time in the military, when I walked into communities with the Canadian flag on my shoulder, or on my chest, the people of the countries that we were there to either help or to work with respected that flag, knew what Canada stood for, and were proud to associate with us. So other people looking at Canada always had a strong belief that Canada was different than every other country in the world, and we were called to provide solutions that others couldn't. And I'm talking about our partners to the south. I'm talking about our ancient partners of Great Britain and France. I'm talking that Canada defined itself differently than every other nation, and a group of Canadians with common ethics and values stood in 1967, and the world knew who we were. We were also prepared to do our part to make sure that we could defend this great country, the sovereignty of our country, and in accordance with our allies, both for the defense of North America, the defense of NORAD, and other treaties. So those two overarching concepts seem to have fallen away, that you need to have unity and that you need to have national security. And we can talk about the other national interests, but national interests are defined by the very core ethics and values of the citizens. And so the idea is, without unity, a country will simply disperse into smaller and smaller groups. And unfortunately, in my experience, in the last decade, what we've seen is leadership at the federal level and sometimes at the provincial order of government intentionally trying to divide Canadians into smaller and smaller groups. And I strongly believe that that is the opposite of what we should be doing.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. I think that perhaps that's probably your key message, is that we need a unity of purpose and a clear sense of national interest. And that is not by accident. That is intentional, and that is a reflection from the top in terms of leadership. And it should be a national mission from coast to coast, and every citizen should have a clear sense of that national purpose. And that doesn't mean that, you know, it's a one that micromanages our lives, but we do have a strong sense of our national purpose. Is that a fair comment?
Absolutely correct. And so without defining a 20 to 25 year vision of what Canada should and could be in 20 to 25 years, we're allowing our politicians to play games, not just our politicians, our media, our academia, to dwell on minor short-term issues, which then have nothing to do with the long-term vision. And I want to talk about diversity. I talk about it in the paper, but diversity is something that constantly people say is a strength. I'm sorry, I've been in countries in massive civil war. I've been in countries where there's been a complete breakdown of law and order. Diversity is never a strength. It's often a weakness. But diversity of values cannot be allowed to exist. Diversity of cultures, definitely. Look at Sweden. They have three predominant cultures within one country. They're a very strong and vibrant country, which has a very clear national vision and very strongly defined national interests. But what they don't have is a diversity of values and ethics.
So those kinds of statements, that diversity is our strength, as an example, I know these are rhetorical statements, but from a policy point of view, let alone a logic point of view, they're kind of nonsensical, are they not? Like, diversity of what? You've got to have a unity of values, otherwise you really are not rowing, to use the rowboat analogy, going in the same direction.
Absolutely correct. And so that's why, to me, the cornerstone of the six national interests that I define in the paper, I always start with unity. And I pull unity apart into pieces so people can look at it and understand it, and try and understand that our political leadership, our academia, all of the citizens of our country need to understand that a unity of ethics and values is cornerstone to defining a country. So when you have groups of people who wish to be Canadians or who are Canadians marching in the streets demanding, once again, a genocide of people in a country, that goes right against the very ethics and values that Canada has in the past stood for and defended with our blood. And so we cannot permit that type of diversity of values and ethics. I'm fine with people from every walk and every country in the world, every culture, every religion, but you have to understand that if you wish to be a Canadian, you have to share the ethics and values which define Canada. So if Canada has become a country whose ethics and values are that genocide is all right, then it's not a country I recognize.
Okay, so point well taken. And we want to go through the kind of the framework of the document, and I know we have a slide here that maybe we could pull up to kind of kind of summarize this. So we've got a number of key themes that you've outlined. Do you want to walk through this briefly, and then we can go through them in more detail, David?
So let me just define that national interests, and there's six of them on this slide, and I offer this as a framework, and I discuss them all in detail in the paper. But what they are the cornerstone benchmark areas that have to be studied, developed, and agreed to by a country. They define the ethics and the values of the citizens. They are the cornerstone documents for a long-term vision of the country. And they become the benchmark so that every decision you make, let's say you want to make a decision on the economy, does it fit with national security? Does it fit with unity? So you have to make your decisions, your policy decisions as a country, referring back to the national interests, which Canadians have agreed to. Otherwise, all your policy decisions become random. And so it then, as a nation, defines for the citizens very clearly how we're going to achieve our 20-year vision in each of those six areas. But what it also does is it tells the world, it tells other nations of the world, this is what Canada's standing for, this is what Canada's national interests are, and this is how we're going to get to a 20-year vision as a participative ally, friend, trading partner, whatever the discussion is from the other people looking in. Other nations have done this and continue to do this. Canada has stopped doing this for at least the past 30 years. We need to stop and engage Canadians in a discussion about each of the six areas of national interest, from unity through national security. And people, when they see national security, they think national defense. National security is much larger than national defense. Good governance, our rights and freedoms. What do we want as citizens of this country, and how will we help others who believe in our same ethics and values? Economic prosperity of growth, personal and community well-being. And I pull them apart in the paper, but the first two, a group of people living within defined borders of common ethics and values, the other four then support the first two.
Okay, so that seems like a very incisive framework of national interests. It is these are very important anchor points, and I'm intrigued by a comment you made earlier, David, that we no longer articulate or teach these points of national interests. We used to. Is that correct? Like you obviously served in the armed forces. You're trained as an officer at the Royal Military College. Are you saying that those types of national interests were once taught systematically?
They're still taught in almost all of the similar institutions worldwide. And I wonder what's taught in the Royal Military College of Canada today, because when I went to RMC, I joined in 1972, 1975, in my third year, there was a compulsory course for every officer. And the first thing you studied were the national interests of Canada, as defined by the Government of Canada and the citizens of Canada back
Oh,
in the
really?
1960s. And
And that's
so
literally
we
what the
had
course
those
was called.
documents, we reviewed those documents, and the reason that we took that course was when we walked out into the world as members of the Canadian Armed Forces, we had to know what we were representing, and we had to be able to talk with our peers at each rank level going up to make sure that we conveyed that Canada stood for this. Canada stood for that. And so we had to know our national interests, and we were examined on them and tested on them, and it was a must-pass course. And then the second half of the year, we studied the national white paper on defense. So we took the national interests, all six of them, and then out of the national security, national interest, and knowing how it fit with all the other pieces of national security, we then had to be masters of our profession, which was national defense. And in those days, there was the five pillars. There was sovereignty, there was defense of North America, NORAD, there was defense of NATO, there was defense of other allies and partnerships, and all other tasks as assigned by the Canadian forces. So back then it was ABCA, the American, British, Canadian Australia groupings, but we were also part of other defense relationships, and understanding the difference between an Article 5 and an Article 6 United Nations mission. And Canada was all over the world in United Nations missions, from Vietnam to the Middle East, all over the world. And so we were taught and required to know first the national interest, so that we knew what we were defending, and then our own profession, which was the White Paper on National Defense. Now, there hasn't been a White Paper on National Defense since the mid-1990s. And I put it to you that the reason there hasn't been a White Paper on National Defense is there hasn't been a serious discussion about the national interest, those six areas that we've defined, since, I believe, the middle 60s. There has not been an updating, a serious discussion, an inclusion of Canadians and senior political leadership in defining a 20 to 25 year vision for our country, and then nailing down the actual details of those six national interests.
Okay. Well, I think a lot of Canadians would be shocked to hear that, because, David, a lot of this sounds like common sense. You need to know, if you're undertaking any mission, you need to know what your foundational assumptions are to undertake the mission. Otherwise, you're going to be vulnerable to all kinds of winds of political change and nonsense that will take you off course. Is that right?
So David, if I can, let me step out of my Army uniform and let's re-engage with the national interest of economic prosperity and growth. If you're a business leader in Canada of a very large or serious corporation, you want to know what Canada stands for to understand whether or not it's worthwhile to invest in Canada. We have one of the lowest foreign and internal investment rates in our own country in the history of our country right now. And that's because
mention there for a sec, David, this last month we heard about a capital outflow of business investment, if memory serves me correctly, of $46.9 billion.
Absolutely correct.
Yes. Please carry on.
So if you don't have a defined national interest in economic prosperity and growth, and you haven't told the citizens of this country, and remember, the citizens of our country work in all of those industries that make up our country, and the senior leaders of those industries, why would anyone want to invest in Canada if they have no idea what the 20-year vision for our country is, and whether or not that industry is even going to be allowed to exist in our country?
Exactly.
As well, other countries coming looking to invest in our country. So when you define your national interests, you tell the public sector and the private sector and the NGOs what Canada is, how they fit, and how to thrive, not survive, how to thrive in Canada as a free and democratic country, knowing that your interests won't be thrown out the window in 5 years.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Unless you have that stability of purpose and clear vision, any investor is going to look at you with suspicion and say, wow, this is a very political jurisdiction. I mean, that's why good governance matters. On all these fronts. And I think in many ways, what you're defining is really good governance for creating a great nation.
I strongly agree, but let me just make it clear. I'm a Canadian, so when I say good governance, I'm talking about good democratic governance. Those same six national interests can be defined by a communist government, by a totalitarian government,
indeed,
because they clearly have defined their six national interests, and good governance for them means locking citizens in their house, monitoring citizens, and getting citizens to tell stories about their neighbors. That's where Canada's going. That's where I, as a Canadian, do not want Canada to go. When I talk good governance, I'm talking about how to strengthen and preserve the democratic way of life in Canada. And in my section on good governance in the paper, you'll see how I've broken it out to ensure that we live in a democratic country where elections are free, not interfered with, where our political leaders stand for the democratic values of our countries, not a post-national state. Because I want to come back to the point that every nation must exist by itself. Nationalism isn't evil. People always say nationalism caused World War II. I put it to you that the nationalism of Great Britain saved the free world. Without the strong nationalist characteristics of Great Britain in 1940, they would have surrendered to Hitler. They wouldn't have resisted Hitler. And same for Canada, the people of Canada who stood with democracies and fought against that tyranny. It was based on pride in our country. And that's why of the five beaches on D-Day, one of the five beaches was manned by Canadians. It was Canadian blood that was spilled on Juno Beach. And we were far overrepresented compared to the rest of the world in freeing Europe. So good governance to me means defense of democracy, where in other countries it can mean absolute control of a totalitarian government. So when you look at those six national interests, they can be perverted by different types of governments to mean different things. My paper's very clearly written from the point of view of a democracy.
Right on. Yeah, and I would underline that as well, that what is the point of having a nation unless it has respect for this incredible gift of self-governance, for individual rights and freedoms, where we can ultimately decide how we're going to live our lives, but within a unified nation. So amen to that. So we know unity is very important for any nation, team. So how do we start moving forward with improving our Canadian security, as an example? I mean, this is, in my mind, a major issue as we look at record numbers of immigrants coming into the country. Obviously, immigration is important. It's a question of how it's managed. We have concerns regarding a certain number of illegal immigrants, as one example. We have external threats from Communist Party of China. There's concerns regarding Chinese influence in our society, including in elections. We have a lot of major challenges, and we don't even have, some would argue, a fully functional military at this point. It's been so degraded in terms of both personnel, equipment, and things like that. Or is that all symptomatic of a lack of regard for what, David?
So it's symptomatic of a country that's in free fall, which has not defined its national interests, and which doesn't seem to have the will to do so. So you asked me for the solution. I want to step us back. A country without a 20 to 25 year vision, cornerstoned and defined by the six national interests that I've defined in my paper, is a country that wanders from crisis to crisis, that supports the use of fear instead of confidence. And we saw the same thing in the pandemic. Good elected officials respond to issues, and in particular crises, with confidence. Confidence that we can manage the crisis, and then lay out for their citizens how we're going to manage the crisis. What I believe we need to do now is to work on defining a 20-year vision for our country, and defining each of those six national interests. Now, I've given a framework, a straw person for people to beat up on and play with and to expand on if they wish. But if we don't, as a group of senior elected officials, academia, citizens, industry, come together to define what do we mean by unity? What do we mean by national security? What do we mean by good governance? What do we mean by rights and freedoms, economic prosperity, personal and community well-being? If we don't frame that, then everything hangs in the ether. Let's talk national security. You brought up immigration. Canada needs to have a complete 100% review of its immigration policy, because right now we don't have one. The immigration policy in Canada is to bring as many people as possible, regardless of ethics and values, into our country as quickly as possible, on the false premise that we need these people because we have a declining population. Well, on the same breath, we're told that AI is going to replace 50% of the workers in our country. There's no logical framework that fits all these pieces together. So if we start with national security and pull it apart, one of the elements being immigration policy, we should only be encouraging people to join our country that meet the first of the national interests, which is unity. We should encourage people who share our common ethics and values, who fight against our common ethics and values, to come and become Canadian citizens. And anyone who has come to Canada who does not respect the unity and common ethics and values which have defined our country should probably then find a new country which does represent their ethics and values.
Okay. But David, on that front, would some say that, well, how dare you create a filter around values like that? I mean, you are becoming, countries have different backgrounds and cultures. And if you start making those kinds of decisions about who comes into the country, then you are a racist. That is wrong.
And so I would come back to you and say that every country in the world defines who gets to become citizens of their country by exactly the method I've just outlined. And I would also put it to you that we are currently seeing the terrible situation which is occurring in the conflict between Hamas and Israel. Mm-hmm. I ask you the question, why is it that not a single Arab country which shares the same religion, the same ethics and values as the people mm-hmm. from Gaza, why has not mm-hmm. one Arab country stepped up to accept the refugees, the immigrants from that region of the world? The reason is they do not believe those people will respect the ethics and values of their unity. Mm-hmm. And yet Canada, without question, has been pushing to accept more and more. So we don't seem to care about our ethics and values, but all the other countries of the world do. Even the countries which share the same religion and values of the people of Gaza. So I'm just saying we need to be a nation. We need to define what we mean by unity. If our ethics and values have changed fundamentally and we do not wish to be a democracy, then Canadians need to be aware of that and need to agree with that. I personally don't think Canadians are aware of that or agree with it.
So, David, in that context, and I'm not suggesting that you have a unique particular insight per se, but help us understand your perspective on why these kinds of short-term political decisions are being made, or is it something else? Is it kind of an ideology that would say, well, we're going to put aside those important foundational values that help build a high-functioning society like Canada, and we're going to think short-term, or we're going to think on a different value page to bring in people that really are not able to engage as full citizens in Canada? That's kind of a brutal reality here, isn't it?
It is, and I believe it's intentional. I believe that the current sitting government truly does believe that the World Economic Forum's concepts and ideals of post-national states is what Canada should be. And they
It's inappropriate to have any borders. Borders should disappear, and there should be a free movement of people around the world, like the UN statement on refugees, I believe it is.
Absolutely. That nations are evil, that nationalism is evil, that there is no single defining culture for a country. And our prime minister has come right out and said he doesn't believe Canada has a single defining culture. Mm-hmm. We should be participating in world crises like the pandemic with an unelected, centralized, global leadership which does not represent the people of a country, but which represents the undefined interests of the world, other than they've defined them very clearly being them being in charge. A nation that elects its own government, that then expects their government to represent them on the world stage, is the opposite of a post-national state. And I believe that the current government of Canada believes in a post-national state and is intentionally walking each of those six national interests away from Canada in a way that will allow Canada to become part of a broken world. That's my opinion.
Okay, so you're hearing that today. I'm talking with Lieutenant Colonel David Redmond on the release of his paper about Canada in 2024 and the need for unity and national purpose, national interests. What do you think? He has laid out a pretty stunning between the eyes analysis of where Canada's at and the need for unity so that we can enable Canada to thrive, not just survive, in this turbulent world that we have with both many external and domestic threats. So, David, when we get look at this paper, I guess one of the things that I'm intrigued about is your analysis about domestic threats. What do you think is the largest domestic challenge that we face as a country?
A lack of unity.
A lack of unity,
A
period.
lack of unity. The internal threats to our country, we have the ability to define both human-induced and natural hazards. We have a way to respond to them. We have an emergency management system within our country that can respond, but it has repeatedly been told to step back. And when we try and take action within our country, we have many, many avenues going in different directions. So we need to define the unity of our country first, and then define how we intend to fulfill all of national security. And so national security is external threats, internal threats, and how we're going to manage and work with each of them. And when I talk about national security, I'm talking about border services, I'm talking about immigration services, I'm talking about policing, I'm talking military is way down my list, all right? And so as you go through each of those institutions, our courts, our justice system are all part of national security. And they need to be working in harmony, and they don't appear to be at this time. We have rampant crime on our streets, and we're recycling the same criminals back out into our society with a bail system that is completely broken.
So when we look at this picture, another way perhaps one could see this is that we have a whole series of incredible Canadian institutions from education, the media, there's just a myriad of them, the courts, you name it, that have been kind of infected by various political directives that really reflect a foreign alien ideology to our traditions of individual rights and freedoms. It's often been said that if you took survey after survey of Canadians, about three quarters of Canadians kind of buy into this kind of traditional view of rights and freedoms and respect for each other, whereas there's this minority that is very much woke, and I use that term, it's a bit confusing, but really take kind of an authoritarian view. They are very much about social justice and trying to achieve equal outcomes in society. And of course, we need to be concerned about injustice, but how you define these things is very important. So wokeism, is that kind of this ideology that you've observed in your analysis that has really infected a lot of these institutions and is creating this mess that we're in now?
I think we, let me take you back to about 1975. I was a new parent. My children are now in all their mid and late 40s. My grandchildren are in their 20s and late teens. When I was a new parent, the discussion started seriously about helicopter parenting. And we all laughed. The people of my generation and just before me laughed at it. They thought it was a joke that parents would come in and remove a child from a difficult situation. Helicopter parenting went on for about 20 years, and then it transmorphed into bulldozer parenting. And I discussed this in the paper. But bulldozer parenting was the what was helicopter parenting on steroids. Instead of removing the child from a difficult situation, bulldozer parents removed anyone from the path of their child who they thought might make their child feel bad. So we've got 40 years of people who are now, the output of that, are around 50 years old. Many of the leaders in our government today at the federal level, the provincial level, and the municipal level. There are people who have been taught that they should not be individually responsible to manage risk, that that's the job of government. We saw it in spades during the pandemic. A virus which was only serious for people over the age of 75 with multiple comorbidities. And so what did our government do? They locked our whole society down for fear of catching a virus, which was not dangerous to people under 75. And the people of Canada rejoiced because they do not believe they're responsible to manage risk personally. It took us a long time to walk here. It's going to take a long time to walk back. But if you're not prepared to manage individual risk, then the whole idea of individual rights and property rights are easily destroyed, because people willingly gave up their individual rights and their property rights in order to be saved from SARS-CoV-2, a virus which was one-tenth as deadly as the seasonal influenza for people under the age of 60. So we've got a society that was by 2015, through helicopter parenting and bulldozer parenting and being raised with the management of risk not being an individual responsibility, they were perfectly primed and ready to accept authoritarian control of a government during this pandemic. And the terrible outcomes of the use of non-pharmaceutical interventions will be with this country until the children that were 6 years old in grade one die in the future. Because those children's education and their ability to have an economically fulfilling life have been broken unless we stop, redefine a 20 to 25 year vision for our country, redefine the national interests of our country, cornerstones of which are based on bullet four, rights and freedoms, and individual responsibility to uphold rights and freedoms, we will be a country that is shattered.
Okay, wow. So you've heard it there again, everyone. David Redmond's analysis of the state of the country. I do have a question from the audience, and that is, what role does education have to play in getting our nation back on track?
Okay, education to me is fundamental. It's one of the institutions that, in my opinion, we've shattered. And so when I talk about the institution, I'm talking about elections, legislation, police, courts, schools, medical, and media. And it's all defined in the paper, but education is fundamental. And if our educators do not have the shared ethics and values and long-term vision of our country, then what they transmit to the children that they're teaching is one where individual responsibility does not exist, where the Charter of Rights and Freedoms is nice to have, but not a must have in a democracy, where it's more important to destroy the economy of a country if it's seen to be for the greater good, never defining what the greater good is through the six defined national interests. So we need to ensure that our academia, whether it's primary school, secondary school, senior high schools, our colleges, our universities, our online learning centers, they need to be a part of a nation that's proud of itself and wishes to continue itself. And I can tell you, the universities I walked out into, remember 1972, the Vietnam War was raging, there was mass protests, there was people in the streets, but it was a full open discourse about what the right felt, what the left felt, what the center felt. The discussion wasn't squashed. It was never shut down. You didn't see universities banning lecturers from giving a differing point of view. And you also didn't see universities taking a side. They allowed the free discussion. They allowed professors to have a free discussion. But the university itself did not say, I stand for Palestine. I stand for Israel. They said, discuss it openly. Academic institutions are where you're taught to think, not where you're taught to have a point of view.
So within that context, then, and to be very blunt, if you think about domestic threats, are universities, frankly, even salvageable when they don't enable freedom of speech? I mean, university after university in Canada, they are dominated, certainly in the humanities and social sciences, by self-described Marxists. They have adopted critical theory as their base for analysis, which is a post truth ideology. It's formed on this constant drumbeat of oppression versus the oppressed. So are they really salvageable, or do we need to kind of defund them and get on with rebuilding something?
All right. People wouldn't believe this having listened to the conversation so far, but I'm a fundamental optimist. I always have been. I've walked into some terrible countries in the world and always believe that you can walk back from an abyss. And we've seen it happen time and again in the world where a country looked like it had gone off the edge of the universe. Sometimes it just takes a lot of time. So, how do we change academia from kindergarten to postgraduate? We do it slowly. I've never been a revolutionary. I've always been an evolutionary because I've seen what happens in a revolution, and hundreds of times more people die, and you rarely get the outcome you thought you were going to get through a revolution. Evolution to me means we start with defining a vision for our country, and we define the six national interests, and we expect political leaders to adopt them. So why do I say that in that fashion? Because universities, in almost all cases, are publicly funded by the provincial order of government. And until our provincial order of government redefines their province's place in a larger confederation based on clear defined national interests, they will not understand what they need to do with the universities. Now, you say defund, I say reorient. So universities need to be told they will not take positions. Funding for a university from taxpayers' funds is based on universities being a place for open discussion. If a university chooses to close a discussion, the person who made that decision needs to be fired. They have breached their contract with the citizens of that province. Their contract needs to be held in breach and they need to be removed. Let me give you an example from the Army. One of the things I learned, and I've talked with other academics all through the COVID. If you take a group of 100 people, five are evil. There's nothing you can do. They're not able to be changed. They are who they are through either through the way they were born or the way they were raised. They're evil. 80% of Canadians are just basically good. 80 out of 100, they're good. They want to go to work. They want to live their lives. They believe in individual responsibility. They will do what's right given the situation. The 15% that I've left out, 80% will just keep going to work. They'll keep doing what's right. They'll keep sustaining the economy. They'll keep sustaining themselves. They'll want to raise their children. That 15% that's left, if they see that 5% getting away with evil, the 15% moves to them because you can make real money real fast if you're evil. The 80% don't change. They don't become evil. They just wait for a real leader and real leadership to emerge that will deal with the 5%. And I saw it over and over and over again in the Army. A battalion with extremely low morale had terrible leadership at the top. You change the leadership at the top, the 5% are still evil, but they go to jail, they get thrown out, they get moved, they get dealt with through a disciplinary or an administrative process. The 15% slide back to the 80%, and you suddenly have a battalion with good morale, and the 80% that were just sitting waiting for good leadership go, right, now let's get on with it, and they work twice as hard. So if you have a provincial order of government that turns to an academic institution, which chooses side in a political debate, which chooses to squish free and open discussion, which fires professors for not holding a party line and you fire the people one at a time. Corporate punishment never works. You don't punish a whole university. You punish the person who allowed the decision or made the decision. Then you replace them with someone and say, your turn. Individual responsibility is the cornerstone of a democracy. When you don't do what your responsibility is, you must then be held accountable. Responsibility links to accountability. So if you then do that one by one and you show you're serious, you do it repeatedly, the message is transmitted that universities are a place for free and open discussion, that no side is back, and that you can have open and free discussion.
No, I think what you're offering, David, as a prescription, as a doctor would offer a prescription, is incisive, as you emphasize accountability. And, you know, today would require a larger discussion and almost an audit of these universities. But it is fascinating that we're finding example after example where universities have introduced DEI or woke measures to both hire people from top to bottom, including the janitors and the professors, and including students who are admitted to every program, including professional schools, including medical school. So we find this quite disturbing, because then you have the whole principle of merit being totally undermined. It's all about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And those are all careful words, all that come from this woke ideology. And I think that this begs the question then, you know, how do you bring those things back on course, as you were talking about? So that's just one of many examples. If you look at institutions across Canada where the purpose, the national interest, is actually defined, but it is totally antithetical to the tradition of our country. It's no longer about classical liberalism and a respect profoundly for freedom and individual rights. It is something entirely different that is based on a socialist, community-minded, social justice approach, and that is fundamentally authoritarian. So is that another way to see this? Is that the persons in charge actually have defined the national interest? They just don't agree with you in terms of how you would define national interest.
Totally correct. So I take you back to my point that I said earlier, that our federal government has embraced the WEF principles of post-national statehood.
Indeed.
This is a very small group of people within the federal government and the cabinet, which have now pushed their thinking out further and further and further over the past 8 years. Let me just use, it's not humorous, but a humorous example of a most recent decision by our federal government, that they will give money to Ukraine for demining operations, but it must be gender neutral. Therefore, there must be the same number of women with bayonets probing for mines as there are for men.
Okay.
I really don't think that the people of Ukraine care about if the minefield's removed by a man or a woman. They want the minefield removed. But our government is imposing an ideology on a totally ridiculous requirement.
Exactly. And this
sorry for talking over you.
No, but example after example where you have a Supreme Court justice of Canada weighing in on a decision saying that we need to redefine woman in a decision. I mean, how absurd is this?
We've allowed the lack of a vision of our country and no definition of national interest to reach this point, on a population that was primed by helicopter parenting and bulldozer parenting. So you have to walk this back slowly, but it has to be done with individual responsibility, and it has to be done with accountability. And our current federal government has to be removed by the election process, but we need to put in place a system of recall that is achievable by the population, the citizens of a country, when they see a government walking away from the basic tenets of our democracy and walking away from the basic interests of our citizens. We have the citizens very clearly making statements about what they do believe in, and a federal government and Supreme Courts saying, we disagree with you, you will do it our way. There has to be a recall mechanism so our democracy can stay a democracy, but that we can hold responsible people who do not reflect the will of the people that elected them, And then accountability must be held on them once removed.
Okay, so we're in the last home stretch of our discussion. David, it's been far-reaching, and so this is not just simply kind of a theoretical concept. A nation needs a purpose, it needs unity. So what do we do when it comes to action? When we talk about action, what can citizens do today that will make a difference? Do they need to call their elected officials and say, get it together on so many fronts? What do we do, David?
We have to start understanding that citizens are responsible for their country. So, absolutely correct. We need citizens to step up and demand that the country stop and reflect, that the country define, and that anyone who wishes to be a political leader must clearly and transparently articulate what they believe Canada should look like in 20 years. If Mr. Trudeau had done that in 2015, I put it to you that the election might have looked completely different. He chose not to say any of those things and run an election based on a complete narrative that has not been achieved. But the citizens must then also participate and demand a full discussion of each of the six areas of national interest to make it a reflection of what they want. So they need political leaders that are going to run for the municipal order of government, provincial order of government, and the federal order of government that they believe will show them how they're going to achieve a 20-year vision based on national interests they can agree with. And we need to start forming serious working groups in our country at each order of government to define the six national interests linked to a 20-year vision. So political leaders working with academia, working with citizen groups, working with industry in our country, and working with all of the people who truly today feel they have no voice.
So today we have a lot of urgent irons in the fire, so to speak, that I would argue really are putting this nation into a position where we truly are at a fork in the roads. And I'll just give you one of many examples, and I know you can give far more than I can. But if you think of Bill C-63, the online harms bill, the using of the word to basically manipulate the issue is stunning. You have part of it that is about so-called protecting children from online pornography and abuse, which is all good. But the laws are already in place to deal with that. But it's really providing cover for a bill that is all about preventing so-called hate speech, which is defined in law now in some measure by precedent, that is all designed to go after anybody that woke activists don't want to hear from in terms of the public discussion. So people that are, quote, genocide deniers, people who are about calling out or disagreeing respectfully about transgenderism, that sex is not based on biology, but that is fluid somehow. This is all very much the purpose of Bill C-63. It's all about redefining and moving away from the rule of law to introducing and emphasizing laws by those in authority and giving some czar, a bureaucrat, the prerogative in a human rights tribunal to define about what you can talk about and what you can. This is a urgent issue, and I think in this context of your paper, David, this is a clear and present danger and urgency for citizens to speak up about this and recognize what's going on before our nation fades away before our eyes.
I totally agree with you. I believe there's a number of pieces of legislation that have been passed with the intention of destroying our economic prosperity, destroying our unity, destroying good governance, that one being a clear example of a destruction of good governance. The funding of the media, the mainstream media, is another clear example of
Indeed,
destroying of
yes.
good governance. And so there are so many pieces that Canadian citizens need to wake up. And I said the same thing during COVID, but I take you back to helicopter parenting and bulldozer parenting. We have a Canadian public which is prepared to accept the removal of risk by government because they don't believe they have any personal responsibility to do it. Hate speech in my time was dealt with in the schoolyard, and now we've made it so that any time that a child touches a child, it's not part of growing up in a world where evil exists, and evil does exist. And in other countries that have bad intentions toward us are allowed to operate in our country freely. We need to walk this back. So yes, there are clear and present dangers, and it all is starts with citizens, that 80% saying no, enough. But in a democratic country that doesn't have recall legislation in place to cause a federal government to lose confidence when it makes a pact with even people that even have greater malintent, we're in a situation where we have to wait for election. And I am the optimist. So let me take you back to Churchill. Democracy is the worst form of government other than every other type we've tried so far. What happens if Canadians actually do wake up and replace this government with a government that does believe in individual rights, property rights, and the responsibility of citizens to manage their own risk? Democracy, like in our country, like every other country, goes through valleys and troughs. It goes through peaks and valleys and peaks and valleys. Any piece of legislation, people say, well, now it's a law. Well, laws are easily overturned, rewritten, or simply discarded. If they make no sense against the national interest, they simply are removed. Courts that currently are supporting an agenda that actually supports a post-national state need to be transformed. And as you see in my paper, I believe there should be term limits on judges in courts. I believe we need to, through evolution, fix the damage that's been done. It will take a decade. It will not happen overnight. But if we don't start now by at least look at the paper, see where you fit in your opinion within the paper that I've presented, and then decide as an individual, what is your responsibility? And I put it to you that every citizen's responsibility in a democracy is to make sure that the person that they elected to represent them knows the opinion they want represented. So a wall of people hitting MPs and MLAs, MPPs desks, or councillors in a municipal government, if they get a wall of opinion coming in, they will realize that if they wish to be reelected, they need to start representing the people they represent. Well, and the silent 80% needs to stop being silent.
I totally agree with you. I think Martin Luther King Jr. once said, the problem is not so much the evil people, it's the silence of the good people. So on that note, we want to thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel David Redmond, for joining us for this live conversation. And we want to thank our audience. And certainly, I think what you've left us all with is a powerful challenge to engage as citizens in this democratic process and not to take those freedoms and responsibilities for granted. And so on that note, thank you so much for your brilliant paper and for joining us today.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.